grateful that at this moment we have an opportunity to bring closure to this very dark chapter in our nation's history.
An alarming pattern of political violence is taking shape in the U.S. What can be done?
Today is Friday, September 12th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour to Los Angeles, where one of the last publicly funded music repair shops works to keep music education accessible for all.
It's going to be somebody's kid, right? You want it to play easily and in tune to give the kid the best opportunity, you know, to succeed on it.
Also, our critic Bob Mondello reviews the film The History of Sound.
And King Princess is out with a new solo album.
She made the record in the music studio her father owns in Brooklyn.
Making a record at that studio feels like the ultimate homecoming because that studio is my DNA.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. Authorities say the search for the gunman who killed conservative activist Charlie Kirk is over. A 22-year-old man was arrested today in connection with Wednesday's shooting at a Utah college campus. Steve Futterman reports.
As he announced that authorities had arrested the suspect, Utah Governor Spencer Cox made a call for national unity.
This is our moment. Do we escalate or do we find an off-ramp?
Although authorities have not shared a motive, Cox said a family member told investigators that Tyler Robinson had become more interested in politics in recent years and had criticized Charlie Kirk's views, which he said were hateful. The Utah governor said political differences should not lead to violence.
It's a choice. It's a choice, and every one of us gets to make that choice.
Formal charges are expected next week when Robinson is due in court. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Orem, Utah.
A man was fatally shot this morning during a confrontation with immigration officers near Chicago. The region is currently in the midst of a heightened immigration enforcement campaign, which is being called Operation Midway Blitz. NPR's Jasmine Garst reports.
The Department of Homeland Security says this morning during an immigration arrest, Silverio Villegas Gonzalez resisted arrest and attempted to flee in his car, dragging an officer with the car. Other officers fired on the vehicle, killing Villegas Gonzalez. The officer he dragged sustained multiple serious injuries but survived. A spokesperson for DHS told NPR that, quote, social media videos and activists encouraging illegal aliens to resist law enforcement not only spread misinformation, but also undermine public safety, as well as the safety of our officers and those being apprehended, end quote. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Consumers are feeling a bit gloomier about the U.S. economy amid rising prices and slowing job growth. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on the latest sentiment survey from the University of Michigan.
The university's index of consumer sentiment dropped more than expected this month. Low and middle income survey respondents sounded particularly nervous about a weakening job market and accelerating inflation. Sentiment is not as bad, however, as it was this spring, shortly after President Trump announced his worldwide tariffs. About 6 in 10 survey respondents this month volunteered that tariffs are affecting their economic outlook. Consumers are also concerned about their personal finances, both now and in the future. People anticipate rising risk to the overall job market and see the odds of losing their own job as higher than 1 in 5. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street finished the week mixed. The Dow declined 273 points. The S&P lost 3, but the Nasdaq added 98 points, finishing at a record high. This is NPR News from Washington. President Trump says he will order National Guard troops to Memphis in what he calls an effort to control crime in that city. The state's Republican Governor Bill Lee of Tennessee said he is working with the White House to finalize the details. The move comes even as the Memphis Police Department said overall crime in the majority black city has reached a 25-year low, and the murder rate has dropped to a 6-year low. A new way to monitor a rise in blood pressure is set to be released next week on Apple Watches. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports that the company's hypertension notification system will use data from the watch's heart sensors.
The optical heart sensor on Apple Watches will analyze how a user's blood vessels respond to heartbeats and can track this data over 30 days, then notify users if it detects signs of high blood pressure. An Apple spokesperson says the feature will be rolled out filed in 150 countries and says it's been cleared by the Food and Drug Administration. More than half of Americans 40 and older have high blood pressure, which can be effectively treated with changes to diet, exercise, and medications. Many adults don't know their risk of hypertension, which is a leading contributor to heart disease and also increases the risk of dementia. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
The Republican-dominated Missouri State Senate has approved a congressional redistricting plan backed by President Trump that could help Republicans win additional House seat in that state. The measure is now being sent to the Republican governor for his signature. However, opponents plan a referendum on the measure statewide. I'm Dan Ronan, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, celebrating 10 years of their German Blonde with a week-long anniversary event, September 30th through October 4th. Includes beer infusions, events, pop-up shops, and live music. Find full details on their Facebook page. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
All Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. This morning, Utah Governor Spencer Cox announced authorities have a suspect in custody for the murder of far-right activist Charlie Kirk.
I'm grateful that at this moment we have an opportunity to bring closure to this very dark chapter in our nation's history.
But in the long hours before his apprehension, speculation about the killer's identity and motivations filled the void. We want to take a moment to step back and talk about political violence and the increasingly familiar pattern taking shape in America. I'm joined now by NPR domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef and NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi.
Hey, great to be with you.
I want to start with what we do know. Tyler Robinson was arrested yesterday. What can we say about him?
Well, we know that he's 22 years old. We know that he's being held without bail in a Utah County Jail at the moment. And according to what we heard from Governor Cox, a family friend told investigators that Robinson had, quote, become more political in recent years. Also, that Robinson didn't like Charlie Kirk. But again, there is still much more to learn.
When Governor Cox, who's a Republican, announced that arrest this morning at a press conference, he called Kirk's death tragic, and then he pulled back and widened the scope. Let's listen.
It is an attack on the American experiment. It is an attack on our ideals. This cuts to the very foundation of who we are, of who we have been, and who we could be in better times.
And let's also listen to the way that President Trump has been speaking out about this moment.
For years, those on the radical left have compared wonderful Americans like Charlie to Nazis and the world's worst mass murderers and criminals. This kind of rhetoric is directly responsible for the terrorism that we're seeing in our country today.
Domenico, I'll put this to you. Two distinctly different messages from two leaders there.
Yeah, very different. I mean, you know, experts will tell us that the way that leaders speak about these moments really matter. You know, calls for unity across the political spectrum, among influencers online and on social media, to be able to take the temperature down is what they say is most important in preventing more political violence. You certainly heard that from Spencer Cox. He was very nuanced in a lot of how he's spoken about this. You know, he talked about violence against Democrats yesterday. He noted today that there was a lot of nuance in how people viewed Charlie Kirk, for example, saying that some people loved him. He certainly had an affinity for him, but that some young people hated him. Those are his words. And so you had very different paths here because President Trump went directly at blaming the left.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really important here is that, you know, Cox was referring to, you know, an attack on the American experiment, you know, this sort of ideal where, you know, we believe that even though we might have a variety of political beliefs and worldviews, we should be able to discuss those with civility and not resort to violence.
We don't yet know the motivation of this alleged shooter, but we are all living in a moment where political violence just feels more common, that it's happening more frequently.
And it is, actually. You know, data from the University of Maryland show that this uptick really started in 2015. But I think we also know this on a visceral level, too, right, Juana? Like, we know about the attempted assassinations of then-candidate Trump last year. We know about, in June, the killing of a Minnesota state lawmaker and her husband and the injury of another state lawmaker there and his wife. There have been many more instances of political violence, and the data has borne that out.
Odette, what do we know about the motivations behind political violence more broadly?
Well, I think what we know is that it's actually a much more complex landscape right now than I think people may realize. You know, I think we often assume that political violence maps onto the divides that we're experiencing in this country. So if something happens to somebody who is politically on the right, you know, people may assume that it was committed by somebody on the left or vice versa. In fact, we are increasingly seeing that that is frequently not the case. Just to take a specific example, you know, the attempted assassination of then-candidate Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania last year. You know, the individual that was involved in that had also been looking at events where President Biden was going to be. And so he may have been looking for a way to commit a high-profile act of violence, really more than seeking an attack within this left-right paradigm. We're also seeing an increase in political violence from what are known as non-ideological actors. So people that are just seeking to sort of destabilize our social fabric by committing violence. This whole idea that it has to be committed by somebody for political reasons at all is really not well supported in the data.
We have seen a number of political leaders on the right, including President Trump, Trump ally Laura Loomer, some members of Congress, clearly blaming the left for this shooting. Big picture, what effect does that have on how we collectively understand this kind of violence?
Well, I think the issue is that it obscures the reality of political violence that we have right now in this country. I'll take another example. You'll recall the killing of the United Healthcare CEO, Brian Thompson. The person that has been charged with that killing, we've seen him being celebrated as a kind of folk hero to the left. This despite the fact that we actually have very little evidence to go on to know what that individual's political beliefs were. We know that he had a specific grievance against the health insurance industry, but we really don't know much beyond that. But that lack of clarity, that muddiness, lends itself to people sort of projecting their own beliefs on what they hope the violence really was about. And that is really a problem because, you know, it obscures the field. It makes it difficult for us to understand how to address political violence when we really don't know the reasons or we're not confronting the reasons that may be behind it.
Yeah, and if I can just say, I've been a little disturbed by some of the reactions to Kirk's death on some corners of social media where there's been this glee celebrating his death. And I have to say, you know, whether you're conservative or liberal, I mean, at a national level, we have elections that put our representatives and senators and a president into office. And I cover politics, and that's the way change is made, not through violence. And I think a big problem in the country, and a lot of people who are concerned about political violence have warned, is that when people lose faith in our institutions and lose faith in the system and they don't believe in politics, that they worry that this is the kind of thing that can happen.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro and Odette Youssef, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
In the film The History of Sound, two young men search for authentic folk tunes as they hike through the backwoods of Maine. Critic Bob Mondello says the World War I era romance is a story of music and heartbreak.
For Lionel, even as a child, music was more than sound.
My father said it was a gift from God, how I could see music. how I could name the note my mother coughed every morning. What the dog across the field was barking.
A Kentucky farm boy, Lionel grows up dirt poor, but gifted enough that in 1917, his town's music teacher gets him a scholarship to study in Boston. He's out drinking with friends there one night when he hears something and cocks his head.
I know that song from home. Excuse me.
He walks over to the piano.
Where'd you learn that?
In some forest in England.
My father used to sing it back in Kentucky.
Did he? David White.
Lionel Worthing. I didn't think people around here knew songs like that.
Well, they don't. This is a hobby in the summers, collecting tunes. What else do you want? More than you, likely.
They spar for a bit, David batting away most of the songs Lionel mentions, until he says...
How about Silver Dagger?
Now it's David's turn to cock his head.
No.
That was such a pretty song.
Well, come on, let's hear it.
I don't usually sing like this with everyone talking.
Oh, excuse me. No. Quiet, no, please.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean that.
Now you have to sing.
So he does.
Don't sing love songs. You'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here right by my side.
Lionel, played by Paul Mescal, seems almost in a trance as Josh O'Connor's David listens wide-eyed. They drink and trade songs and near dawn leave the bar for David's apartment where they fall without much thought into an embrace and then a romance that only ends when David's drafted into World War I.
I leave this week.
Lionel, whose eyeglasses make him ineligible, tries at first to make a joke.
Send chocolate. Don't die.
David doesn't send chocolate, but 2 years later he does come back and asks Lionel to join him for a summer in rural Maine, recording local folk songs on Mr. Edison's wax cylinders. It's an unfamiliar concept to the locals.
Sound comes down this big horn here and it shakes this needle, which cuts a line in the wax.
How does that catch the sound?
Put your hand on your throat. Now hum.
David's look as he watches Lionel would melt all the wax in the world.
Vibration.
Their summer of ethnomusicology is eventful and passionate, but the outside world also intrudes, and as the weather cools and it's time to part, Lionel feels a chill from David. In the film's second half, director Oliver Hermanis takes the story to Italy and Britain, but it's in the hill country of Maine and Kentucky that he creates a sort of music-filled Eden for these two. Based on what was originally a short story by screenwriter Ben Shattuck, this tale of gay longing shares some narrative DNA with Brokeback Mountain, but its closeted lovers are even less vocal, and as the heartbreak deepens, the filmmaker unfortunately seems determined to match their restraint with his own, which leaves the music to lift and carry the history of sound, music that exalts and wounds and haunts. I'm Bob Mandela.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered this Friday afternoon here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. We receive support from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. The KAXE newsroom has created a map of northern Minnesota's farmers markets throughout our region, from places like Park Rapids to Palo and Black Duck to Crosby. Most markets run through September or October. Find the map at kaxe.org. And we receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. The National Loon Center in Cross Lake is hosting Loon Pontoon Tours Fridays and Saturdays through the month of September. Make reservations at nationalloonscenter.org. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KAXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for details at 218-326-1234. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly breakfast buffet Sunday, September 14th from 9 to noon at the Buck Lake Community Center. located 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. The Bemidji Community Latin Block Party is 4:30 to 7:30 Wednesday, September 17th at BSU's American Indian Resource Center, featuring free local food, music, games, and raffle prizes. Greenwood Cemetery in Bemidji is looking for volunteers to help with recovery efforts after this summer's derecho. Anyone with availability and equipment is welcome to join the effort before winter comes. Text KAXE at 218-326-1234 for contact information.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Downton Abbey, the grand finale, concluding the story of the Crawley family. This motion picture event can be experienced in theaters today. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. A year ago, I might have described King Princess as a hugely popular singer-songwriter. But now, she's become a lot more. In May, she made her TV debut playing an emotionally blocked piano prodigy on season 2 of Nine Perfect Strangers.
I was worried about you.
Yeah, I was having a nightmare. I was having a very on-the-nose nightmare.
She's about to play Hugh Jackman's daughter in a movie called Song Sung Blue. They did this duet at Radio City Music Hall a few months ago.
Come on, KP. I got you, babe.
And now King Princess is out with a new solo album called Girl Violence. The New Yorker called it, quote, her best yet, which cements her status not only as a virtuosic provocateur, but as a generational talent. Which generation? She's 26. Here's the lead single, R.I.P.K.P. King Princess is the stage name of Michaela Strauss, who is with us now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
What a beautiful intro.
Thank you. Well, you've had quite a year. It's not over yet. At this moment, when you look back on the mountains you've climbed, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. This has been such an amazing and bizarre year. I spent 6 months in Germany filming that show. I made the record kind of before and after that experience, and I signed to an indie label, Section One and Partisan.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's just been a lot of movement and change, but all good stuff.
Well, there's been a ton of movement beyond what you just mentioned. I mean, good stuff, but also, like, you relocated from LA to New York. You ended a four-year relationship with the woman you had been with. You, as you say, left your record label and re-signed. How did all of that dramatic change shape the music that's on this album?
For me, I think my last record was written in this state of, like, immobility and sadness. And I kind of, I've become a bit of like a hoe for sadness. And I think
it can be addictive.
It's, well, especially as queer people, I feel like we're obsessed with being miserable. So I kind of had this internal monologue going the whole time of, like, my therapist being like, do you want to stay sad or do you want to do something about it? And I started to kind of piece by piece dislodge these points of sadness, these thorns, you know, and just started to pull them out.
And the weeds you reach for me, and in the weeds I found my peace.
I think about the track Origin, where you say, it's been a little rough for a minute. I've had to face fire, fight fear, and spend a lot of time in the mirror. And then you eventually get to, I'm starting to feel myself again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, take us to that moment. Where did that come from? What was that about?
Well, that song was interesting because I wanted to start kind of the first chapter of the record with this idea that, like, the feeling of walking to the studio, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm walking from my house to my dad's house, listening to the Symphony of New York and thinking about what I want to write this record about. And that song to me feels like that process, you know, with headphones on, walking down the street, like, what am I going to write about today?
I'm cool, I'm with her. I'm high, I'm deeper. I'm starting to feel myself again. I'm
You know, how am I going to elevate the emotional call here?
Yeah.
And that song feels like a declaration of where I'm at, where I want to be, and what I hope this record will give me by writing it.
Yeah. Walking to your dad's place, as you say, you recorded this album at the studio that your dad has run in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, since the 90s.
Yeah.
Where do you think that DNA comes through here?
Making a record at that studio feels like the ultimate homecoming, because that studio is my DNA. You know, the equipment in that studio were my toys as a child.
Yeah.
So I get a little woo-woo about equipment and studios and rooms and the way they sound. And one of the things I love about that studio is that it feels really alive. It feels like a person. It feels personified. She's an important character in the record, I think. If I can make it easy for you, if I can make it easy, if I can make you feel that you're good.
Okay, well, if you want to get woo-woo, I'm thinking about, like, the hero's quest, where you go far afield and then you finally come home and you, like, reclaim the thing that is your inheritance, your family legacy. I mean, it almost feels mythic.
Well, thank you, because I am obsessed with Gilgameshian journeys. I'm, like, really on my Gilgamesh right now.
Cool.
There was, like, a period of a week while I was making the record where I watched, in 1 week, The Revenant, and then Children of Men, and then The Road, and I was like...
You've got a slightly lower body count than some of those. I mean, I assume.
Like,
I don't know.
I kind of was like, I feel like that man. I feel like that man trying to get from point A to point B, except instead of being that man and my obstacle being actual travel, it's emotional travel through being a lesbian. Like, I was like, if that protagonist was a lesbian having to conquer the evilness of women, that's me.
Okay, so take us to the spot on the album where it's like the triumphant homecoming. Like, you are back in your father's studio, the site of your childhood experiences, and now you're in control of all the machines in it.
I think the song Jamie would be one of the songs I would say is the most triumphant.
You talking about this kind of triumphant return reminds me of something you told the New York Times 5 years ago. They wrote, if King Princess becomes a superstar, it will be because Michaela Strauss willed it. And then you're quoted as saying, it's going to be an I told you so moment. I'm going to be like, what were you all waiting for? So is this that moment when you get to say I told you so?
No, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. It will be. It will be an I told you so moment, but I would be lying if I said it was right now.
And so what's in your sights? Like, what's the...
I think that this record is the closest I've felt to the way I felt making the EP in my, you know, like, leaving my...
You mean your
my
very college. First breakout
yeah.
hit, 1950?
Yeah. Yeah, and all those songs on Make My Bed, I feel like I wrote those songs because I needed to write those songs, right? Like, I was in my dorm room, I was heartbroken, I was going from school to the studio, and it was like therapy. This record feels the closest to that I've had in an extremely long time, and I think that that's a really good sign.
Michaela Strauss, who performs as King Princess, her new album is Girl Violence. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Support comes from Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, presenting Miletici, new music from the old country. Sam Miletich and his friends will take the stage on Saturday, September 13th at 7 p.m. Tickets available at the door. Info at edgecenterarts.com. upnorth.org. Now for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Minnesota county leaders are expecting a significant shift in cost to their budget from the state and federal governments because of various legislation. In Beltrami County, proposed cuts to libraries and the local history museum are on the table to offset the burden. Larissa Donovan has the story.
County Administrator Tom Berry says a committee worked to deliver an increase of less than 10% to the proposed property tax levy for 2026. At a recent meeting, he pointed to cost shifts as driving factors, including for probation, health and human services like Medicaid and SNAP, and the state's new Paid Family and Medical Leave Act.
That's why the tax pie is starting to get bigger. And you can expect that to grow if the state continues down the path that is headed.
The board set a list of budget priorities earlier in the year, which included financing mission-focused operations such as health and human services before giving money to outside organizations. This includes the library system and historical society. At the Bemidji Public Library, branch manager Sherilyn Warren says the proposed reduction will bring the county's contribution down to what's known as the minimum maintenance of effort as part of the state's library system. This year, Beltrami County gave nearly $438,000 to the Bemidji and Black Duck Libraries. The Kitchigami Regional Library System requested just over $450,000 for the two libraries for 2026, but Beltrami County proposes far less, about $265,000.
Even if we committed to cutting all material purchases for 2026, which is not buying any new materials, we would still have to find over $100,000 to cut from our budget for 2026. And feasibly, the only way to do that would be to cut hours of operation and to cut staffing levels.
Beltrami County Historical Society's Executive Director Emily Thabe says Beltrami County's proposed $7,500 cut represents about 8% of the center's annual budget.
Dollars that we miss now, that is history that turns to dust. It is history that rusts and crumbles and is not digitized and is not saved. And it's decades that gets washed away from our memories.
The county is expected to set its preliminary budget and levy for 2026 at its meeting Tuesday. The levy amount can be decreased between then and December when the final decision is made. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
Drivers should expect delays on Highway 2 in Grand Rapids next week. The Minnesota Department of Transportation says milling and paving work begins Monday. Work will take place in the city the first 2 days, including on Southeast 7th Avenue and Northeast 8th Avenue. Tuesday through Friday, crews will work between Northeast 3rd Street and Culp Road east of La Prairie. There may be extended delays, especially during commuting hours. MnDOT says to expect flagging operations, lane closures, and pilot cars. Highway 7 near Iron Junction will close for about 5 days starting Monday. St. Louis County says crews will be working on the CN Railroad crossing between Old Mesabi Road and Ramshaw Road North. The recommended detour is lengthy, routing drivers to Highway 53 via Highway 37 or through Eveleth. The University of Minnesota is accepting nominations from Northwestern Minnesota for its Growing Local Leadership course. The program aims to address the growing governmental and nonprofit leadership shortage in the state. The hybrid course includes online and in-person meetings at Shooting Star Casino in Monoman. The sliding scale fee includes meals and lodging. Nominators are asked to consider young adults, college students, new residents, empty nesters, and people from underrepresented groups as future leaders for their communities. The U uses a broad definition of Northwest Minnesota, stretching from Morris to Park Rapids to Bedette. Applications and nominations close Monday. Find more information at kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at kaxe.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. Sign up for the Buzz newsletter for the week's best stories and audio from your favorite community radio station. I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This week, Brazil witnessed the dramatic fall of Jair Bolsonaro, the so-called Trump of the tropics. The former president was sentenced to 27 years in prison for plotting a coup. So is this the final chapter of his political career? Julia Carneiro reports from Rio.
This was the scene at a campaign rally 7 years ago. Jair Bolsonaro hoisted on a supporter's shoulders, waving to the crowd. Once an obscure political maverick, the former army captain and seven-term congressman had little national relevance until he became a symbol for a frustrated electorate.
He became famous for being outrageous, you know, supporting torture and supporting killing his opponent.
That's sociologist Celso Rocha de Barros, a political columnist and podcaster. By the 2010s, Brazil was rocked by corruption scandals and recession, and Bolsonaro rode the wave of anger against the political establishment. Bolsonaro ignited a patriotic anti-leftist movement. He survived an assassination attempt, and in 2019 was sworn in as president in Brasilia. Anthony Pereira is the executive director of the Stone Center for Latin American Studies at Tulane University.
He was much more effective, in my view, as a movement leader than he was as a president.
Bolsonaro championed gun rights, conservative family values, attacked women and LGBTQ people, and flaunted unfiltered bravado online, earning the nickname Trump of the Tropics. He spread disinformation during the pandemic and cast doubt on Brazil's electoral system, which made him increasingly unpopular, paving the way for the comeback of his leftist rival, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, and Bolsonaro's defeat in the 2022 election. Then came January 8, 2023, and in scenes reminiscent of the storming of the U.S. Capitol in 2021, thousands of Bolsonaro supporters draped in Brazil's flag stormed the presidential palace, Congress, and Supreme Court just days after Lula's inauguration, smashing property while calling themselves patriots. This week, the Supreme Court ruled these riots were the climax of a coup attempt masterminded by Bolsonaro, finding him guilty of attempting to overthrow the government, leading a criminal organization, and undermining the rule of law. Bolsonaro's defense called the sentence excessive and is considering appeals, yet with the 2026 elections approaching, his support could still have an impact on the vote. Even before the trial concluded, thousands of Bolsonaro supporters took to the streets demanding amnesty. In São Paulo, they waved U.S. and Brazilian flags, thanking Trump for backing Bolsonaro. For now, the political career of Bolsonaro is most likely over, but his presence still haunts Brazil's democracy. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro.
In Los Angeles, school is back in session. That also means band and music programs are in full swing.
One, two, three.
At San Fernando High School, mariachi music streams out of Sergio Alonso's classroom. A big part of school music programs is keeping the instruments in working condition. In the LA Unified School District, that happens at one of the last publicly funded repair shops of its kind. Now, that shop is getting a tune-up of its own, with a $1 million donation from a music legend. For our ongoing Here to Help series, NPR's Janaki Mehta reports.
In the midst of a bustling industrial corridor of downtown Los Angeles, a pair of double doors lead into a warehouse.
Come on in, it's open.
Steve Bagmanian greets me. He started as a piano technician here 22 years ago and supervises the shop now.
There's some French horns, some saxophones and clarinets.
This is where thousands of ailing instruments from all over LAUSD come to be nursed back to health. handful of technicians are hunched over their stations. Bright work lights shine over the instruments they're tinkering with.
I've been in this station for 21 years.
That's Patty Moreno, a technician who specializes in brass instruments. Today, she's working on a broken baritone horn.
The pistons were stuck, so we put it apart. And we go and wash it.
Many of the students in this district didn't even know their instruments got sent here for fixing. And that's changed since this place was featured in a documentary called The Last Repair Shop, which won an Oscar last year. Moreno is glad the shop is more visible now. She says this is hard, specialized work, a dying craft. And she says she is often thinking about the students on the other end of the repair. A few feet away, Dwayne Michaels is soldering a dented saxophone.
It's going to be somebody's kid, right? And so you want it to play as easily and in tune to give the kid the best opportunity to succeed on it.
Any beginning student, when he doesn't have the good instrument, he's going to hate that instrument. He's not going to learn.
That's Bogmanian again, who says these early encounters with working instruments can be the difference in making a lifelong musician.
That's why it's so important that every instrument that gets out of here, it's in good condition.
For many young people, cost is a big barrier to getting an instrument. LAUSD serves about 80% of students who are considered economically disadvantaged. Studies have shown that students from lower-income backgrounds are less likely to have access to quality instruments in music programs. And Bogmanian says he has seen cuts to the shop in the past. All of that means $1 million donation to the shop could make a big difference.
Well, you never know where a genius is laying.
That's legendary musician Herb Alpert, who's making that donation. Alpert's got a connection to this district. It's where he got his start making music in the 1940s.
Oh, yeah, lucky me. I was 8 years old in my grammar school, and there was a table filled with various instruments, and I happened to pick up the trumpet.
Alpert is an 8-time Grammy winner, musician, record producer, but at first he says he couldn't make a sound on the trumpet.
I'm a card-carrying introvert. And once I started making a good sound out of the horn, it was saying the things I couldn't get out of my mouth. It was a good feeling. And I thought, man, I had this magical opportunity when I was 8 years old. I'd like to pass that on.
Back at San Fernando High, 11th grader Maximiliano Segura tells me he shares the experience of falling in love with the trumpet when he was around 8 years old, too.
It was cool and shiny. No, it really appealed to me when I first saw it. Like, I knew that it was a part of, like, many genres, like jazz or, like, mariachi.
He's played a district-owned trumpet for free since the third grade.
I love music. I think it's just one of my best therapies, and I feel like everyone should have the opportunity to express themselves.
Herb Alpert, who is 90 years old and continues to play tours, says he often asks himself if he would have found his way to music had he not picked up that trumpet in elementary school.
The arts should be not a privilege, but it should be in the public school system. This is a crucial part of a child's development.
While Alpert has long been known for his philanthropy, he says he feels more urgency in the current political climate to help keep music in young people's lives. Maximiliano Segura says he's grateful he gets to finish school with a working trumpet in hand.
To know that people from my background are accessible to instruments and music itself, it's amazing to know that.
Now he's putting money away into a piggy bank to save for his own trumpet so he can keep making mariachi music for the rest of his life. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Typhus is a disease many thought was a thing of the past. Now it's making a comeback. Health officials are reporting a rise in cases, especially in Texas. As Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davis reports, it's taking many by surprise.
When Dana Clark plays her antique parlor organ these days, it takes extra effort. While vigorously driving the foot bellows, she fingers the black and white keys.
My great-grandmother's pump organ. It's 120 years old.
In May, 76-year-old Clark contracted typhus from clearing weeds from her garden.
I created a lot of dust, And just inhaling that dust can give someone typhus because flea excrement.
Days after exposure, symptoms often begin with high fever, headache, and body aches. A rash can also appear, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. When treated promptly with antibiotics, outcomes are usually good. But delayed diagnosis increases the risk of complications and hospitalization. That's what happened to Clark.
It's still not an extremely well-known disease.
Dr. Gregory Anstead is a San Antonio-based infectious disease specialist. He has conducted extensive research into the resurgence of flea-borne typhus in Texas.
In the 1990s, there were only about 200 cases in the state of Texas. 2010 to 2019, the number of cases went up 12-fold.
The number of typhus cases is climbing in Texas, California, and Hawaii. In Los Angeles County, for example, typhus cases rose from 31 in 2010 to 171 in 2022. Because the disease had been so rare, the CDC doesn't track typhus cases, but historically it was a common scourge. In the 1940s, it was so widespread in San Antonio that the city was used as an experiment.
Health authorities of the city of San Antonio, Texas, attacked the germ carriers throughout the city.
The U.S. Public Health Service took, several tons of DDT. They spread it to 22,000 rooms in urban San Antonio.
This citywide anti-typhus blitz worked. The number of typhus cases dropped, and the war against typhus fleas and rats spread across the South.
The combination of insecticide treatment with DDT and also spreading these new rodenticides, definitely interrupted this transmission cycle of typhus.
But now typhus is back. Climate change is creating better conditions for the malady. Fleas and typhus bacteria thrive in the warmer temperatures. Rat populations are also booming due to a warming climate. A study recently published in Science Advances finds rat numbers are up in cities including Washington, D.C. and New York, all of which fuels transmission.
It's been a long ordeal.
Clark is back to playing the piano and giving music lessons. She recommends people wear an N95 mask while pulling weeds to avoid breathing in typhus-infected dust. For NPR News, I'm David Martin Davies in San Antonio.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48 this Friday evening, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Headwaters Music and Arts in downtown Bemidji, offering music lessons and art programming for all ages. More at headwatersmusicandarts.org or on Facebook and Instagram. Happy Dancing Turtle and Pine River invites you to their garden Thursday, September 18th from 1 to 4. Learn about seasonal strategies, hoop houses, and more. Support comes from AW Research Laboratories in Brainerd, reminding private well owners to test their drinking water annually. Common well contaminants such as bacteria, nitrates, and arsenic are odorless, tasteless, and colorless. More information and test kits available at awlab.com. United Way of Northeastern Minnesota is looking for lunch buddy mentors at elementary schools in Aurora, Cherry, Chisholm, Eveleth, Hibbing, Keewatin, Mountain Iron, and Virginia. The deadline to apply is September 26. Find more information at unitedwaymn.org/volunteer. And support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Wi-Fi to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaimed Reframed now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 5 and Sundays 11 to 4. United Way of 1000 Lakes has many volunteer opportunities in Itasca County. Find a list and sign up at volunteer.uwlakes.org. Now back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. When the NBA starts back up next month, the last few seconds of any given period might have a little more of this.
It's quickly into Luka, and he got it away from about 40 feet.
Yes!
He made it! He made it!
Yes!
Jalen Smith, he'll have to launch it from half court.
Butler bounces Curry. Oh!
Ridiculous! A cheat code!
The NBA is changing a rule for the upcoming season. At the end of the first, second, and third quarters, desperation shots at the buzzer from way far away, at least 36 feet from the basket, will no longer count against an individual player's shooting statistics. The responses to this news have been mixed and honest.
I mean, my question is, can something be smart and lame at the same time? It feels like another example of like post-millennial grade inflation here. You know, the idea of consequence-free half-court heaving.
That is sports columnist Jason Gay with the Wall Street Journal. He says for years it was rumored that players wouldn't take those Hail Mary shots because the likely outcome was a miss, which would hurt their shooting percentages. And having good stats, it's not just an ego thing.
The NBA, we hear this often, this cliche, it's a make-or-miss league, and it's also a make-or-miss contract increasingly. If you hit those shots, if you have that 40% plus three-point contracts, that's often the difference between a livelihood and not in the NBA.
At least part of this conversation was kicked off by the heroics of a backup point guard in Boston.
Look no further than the mania around the Boston Celtics' Peyton Pritchard, who I think is the reigning king of the half-court to three-quarter shot.
In last year's NBA Finals, Pritchard sank two last-second shots from deep downtown.
Missed free throw, four for the rebound. Here's Pritchard. He loves these. Puts it up half-court of the buzzer. Bang! He's done it again! They put him in for these situations. No hesitation.
Now, according to Sport Radar, players only made about 4% of these end-of-quarter heaves last season. But the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay speculated this rule change might even spur teams to draw up plays for very long-range jump shots.
You know, maybe we are ushering in an era of the specialist, you know? What if we start to cultivate these ringers who can come in and hit 70-foot shots? I mean, how wild would that be?
Pretty wild enough for, I don't know, 4 points if you ask me. Mm-hmm. Although, Juana, I will note that under these rules, Steph Curry already made four such half-court heaves last season alone.
Spinal Tap, the band from the beloved 1984 mockumentary about a fictional rock band, is back. Their new movie is called Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues. Here with me to talk about that sequel and its rockin' soundtrack is Raina Duras, host of WXPN's World Cafe. Hi there.
Hi.
Raina, can you just start by reminding us all who this band is and what made the original Spinal Tap so amazing?
Okay, well, Spinal Tap was one of the first mockumentaries, which is a genre of film and TV that's gone on to become very, very popular. And the band is a parody of a rock band poking fun at all the excess and self-seriousness that comes along with that. But what I think made it really special was the chemistry between Christopher Guest, Michael McKean, and Harry Shearer, who play the band members Nigel Tufnell, David St. Hubbins, and Derek Smalls. A lot, maybe most of the film is improvised, and it really is just like great joke after great joke the entire way through.
Okay, and now it's been about four decades, and they are back. So tell us, where does this new movie pick up, and what are these characters all up to?
Okay, well, they've all aged a lot and are living very different lives. Nigel is working at a cheese and guitar shop, playing in a folk band. David is making music for true crime podcasts and that music that plays when you're on hold on the phone. Derek is running the Museum of Glue. And then they find out that they have this contract where they're obligated to do one more show together. So they all reunite and chaos ensues.
Love that. Okay, so as host of World Cafe, you have listened to probably thousands of phenomenal bands. So how does Spinal Tap hold up? Is the soundtrack good? And I will just note that I have heard that there's maybe a superstar cameo or two.
Yeah, I mean, you can really hear that they are having so much fun. There are some new tracks they've done for the movie, and a bunch of old ones from the original have been re-recorded, like the song Listen to the Flower People.
Flower people walking by. Flower people, don't you cry.
A classic. A few of them also do have celebrity guests. You've got Garth Brooks is in there. Trisha Yearwood is on there. Elton John appears in the song Stonehenge, which is performed during the climax of both films, actually.
Stonehenge, where a band's a band, and the children dance to the pipes and pans.
And I think my favorite cameo is Paul McCartney. He shows up for a version of the song Cups and Cakes, which only appeared in the first movie as a song playing in the background on the radio. It is very British, and it is very... it's perfect for Paul McCartney.
Cups and cakes, cups and cakes. Oh, what good things mother makes. You've gotta take tea, won't you take it with me? What a gay time it will be.
That is incredible. Raina, I wonder, seeing these actors and rock stars on screen 40 years later, what was most surprising for you?
Well, one thing about rock and roll is that it's a genre that really idolizes youth and being sexy and reckless. But here we're seeing these guys as old men. Both the actors and their characters are dealing with aging in the entertainment industry. They do get into things like dealing with mortality, which is sort of a theme in rock music, if you think about it. Rock music is full of death and graves and blood, and all those things are very, very rock and roll. The thing is that the Spinal Tap members may be technically older, but they haven't emotionally matured at all since the original. The characters are really exactly the same.
It's incredible. Before we let you go, do you have a favorite song from the movie that we should go out on?
Yeah, speaking of that aging and mortality thing, there is a new song that they did for this movie called The Devil's Just Not Getting Old. Has some great lines about how the devil is still into flame, how he's still testing extremely well. I just think it's a good reminder that you may be aging, but you're never too old to rock.
He's not starting to lose his teeth. He's not starting to eat less.
Raina Duras, host of World Cafe at WXPN in Philadelphia, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Rock on.
Indeed. And you can also hear Raina on today's episode of New Music Friday from NPR Music. And Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues, is in theaters today.
He's not complaining of shooting pains. He's not having varicose veins. He's not experiencing shrinking. His full story's not been told. He's still testing extremely well. He's still running a hell of a hell.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Subaru, the 2025 Subaru Outback features symmetrical all-wheel drive plus standard safety features like EyeSight Driver Assist technology. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving northern Minnesota, carrying Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram vehicles with staff available to assist on the Beltline in Hibbing or at HibbingChrysler.us. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy with patchy fog, lows 56 to 61 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny with highs in the upper 70s, low 80s, evening lows in the upper 50s, and Sunday, highs in the upper 70s, mid 80s, partly sunny. Now for As It Happens.